Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, you could make a pretty good case that Joseph Stalin was the most evil person that ever lived. He was responsible for the deaths of up to 20 million people. He took pleasure in degrading and humiliating people, including his close associates, and even refused to allow a prisoner exchange, which would have saved his own son from dying in a Nazi concentration camp. Not a great guy. But he also grew up in poverty and was repeatedly beaten by his alcoholic father. So, to what degree can we say that Stalin was born evil, and how much of his behavior can be explained by his upbringing? Can evil be encoded in our DNA? Well, that's a question we're asking Catherine Page Harden. She's professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin and author of Original Sin, The Genetics of Wrongdoing, The Problem of Blame, and The Future of Forgiveness. She joins me now. Page, welcome to the program. Tell me about this book, because this is a subject that I talk about a lot. I talk about it with my children. I think about it a lot. And I'm very much firmly in the camp that we are, you know, we really are just following our environment and following the genes that we have. And if someone ends up being a horrible person, there's a reason for that.
Yes. I mean, I'm a psychologist. I'm a clinical psychologist, a developmental psychologist. So I study how do children turn out to be the people that they become. And I would say that your perspective that it's nature and nurture, but a lot of the things that people didn't control shape who they are, is exactly what we also see evidence for in the science. So this book is me really trying to grapple with, well, what does the science say and what are the implications of that?
Before we talk about the science, as a clinical psychologist, when you found behavior that was morally reprehensible in one of your clients, was that almost always linked to a poor childhood upbringing, a bad experience at home, some sort of trauma or loss? Do you ever really get people who do kind of disturbing things that haven't been subjected to some horrible thing as a child?
So the most common family upbringing that you see in people who commit acts of violence is that they were victims of violence themselves too, or some sort of deprivation, some sort of environmental stress. If you're looking at, say, incarcerated populations in the United States, the trauma history and the maltreatment history in that population is extraordinarily high. But it's not universal. You do see cases, they're rarer, but they are there, where people don't seem to have anything in their background that you can point to and you can say, that's why they ended up this way. There is no kind of smoking gun in their environment. And at the same time, you see that, you know, even people who commit violence and they do have a maltreatment history or an abuse trauma history, they might have siblings who experience that same environment, but they also didn't grow up to be violent or to be aggressive or to behave in ways that we would call evil. So it's not a one-size-fits-all story for everyone. It seems to be that some people, it's, you know, we can really point to the environmental explanations. Some people, it doesn't seem like there's much of an environmental explanation there, and there's something really maybe abnormal about their genetics. And for the vast majority of people, it's both. It's this nature-nurture combination where they experience an insult, and then also they have genes that make them respond to that insult in a particular way.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, when it comes to those people who are violent, but they don't seem to have any environmental reason for it, like they don't have any childhood trauma, I mean, it's difficult to know exactly what happened to any child. You know, they could have blocked it out, or they may not remember it. But, you know, that pattern of abuse, as you say, is pretty common. But the idea of genetics influencing violence or evil or wrongdoing is really, really interesting. So what can we say about the genetic component of, I mean, I guess it's difficult to talk about, you know, decision-making. Violence is a much cleaner sort of way to talk about doing wrong, right? So what do we know about genes and violence?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways that we study how genes influence any behavior, and that includes violent behavior or aggressive behavior. And one way is looking at how does it run in families, even when children aren't raised by their biological parents. So if you were adopted away at birth and your biological father, whom you've never met, was arrested or convicted of a violent crime, does that predict anything about your likelihood of committing a violent crime? And it turns out that it does. So there is some familial resemblance in violence, in aggression, in impulsive behavior across the board, even when people are not being raised by their biological parents, which is a really strong clue that there's something being genetically transmitted across the generations.
Is that a strong relationship? Because that's really surprising to me. Because, you know, you would imagine that, you know, if you had a father who beat up all of his first three kids, but his fourth kid was adopted away, you'd imagine that that child is safe from that environment. But you're saying that there's something genetic that passes down.
Yes. So it's not deterministic. It's rare. We're never really talking about certainties in science. We're talking about odds and probabilities. But some studies have put it about 1.5 or 2 times more likely to commit a violent crime yourself if your biological parent, who you never met, also committed a violent crime. So that doesn't mean you're destined for crime, but it does mean that there's something that's being inherited that's increasing your probability. Mm. And then what we also see is we can now look directly at the DNA sequence. So we can have people spit in a tube or give a blood sample, and then we can look directly at what DNA letters, what's your unique DNA sequence. And if we do that for large enough samples, we can look to see, are there particular DNA sequences that are more common in people who are committing violent or aggressive acts? Mm. And we can find those patterns. And again, in the vast majority of cases, this isn't deterministic. There isn't one gene, you know, that's going to predestine you to be aggressive. But we can see combinations of genes scattered out throughout the genome that do raise your probability of engaging in aggressive behavior. And the strength of those associations are about as strong as what we see for a maltreatment history or being bullied in school.
Wow.
So not everyone who's bullied in school goes on to be aggressive. Not everyone who's abused by their parents goes on to be aggressive. Not everyone who inherits these patterns of genes goes on to be aggressive. But it does raise your probability in a statistically significant way that we can see in the data.
Right. One of the genes that we associate with aggressive behavior is this MAOA gene, aka the warrior gene. Tell me about this gene and the various variants of it, because this study or this Dutch family story is fascinating.
Yeah. So everything that I've been talking about so far is, you know, common variants. So looking at genetic differences that are scattered throughout the genome that make a small difference to your behavior. But in very rare cases, you find these genetic mutations that have a really large effect. And the most famous one of these is this MAOA gene. So it is a gene that codes for an enzyme that ordinarily breaks down neurotransmitters, which are the chemicals that your neurons use to communicate to each other in the brain. So this was discovered in a Dutch family where all of the women in the family were functioning normally, but the men in the family had a really high rate of violence and aggression. So one stabbed his boss with a pitchfork, one committed arson, multiple of them were in prison, many of them had committed sexual offenses, some against their sisters. And I'm not even really sure how they came to medical attention in the first place. But when they looked at this family, they realized that there was a mutation on this MAOA gene, which is on your X chromosome. And since men only have one X chromosome, if they inherited this mutation, it really profoundly affected their behavior. Whereas women have two X's. So even if they inherited the mutated version, a little bit like male pattern baldness or color blindness, they weren't as affected by it or they weren't affected by it at all. So this was something where it's one gene, it's one DNA letter change in that gene, and yet it had a massive effect on people's behavior. And it really brings up the question that I'm grappling in this book is, what does it mean to be responsible for your actions? Mm. You know, these people have committed horrible acts if they are also, their behavior is being so profoundly shaped by this gene that they happened to inherit.
So how common is this gene? Because you say it's rare, but I'm assuming that with modern day technology, when we have someone who commits really violent crime, we're sequencing their genome. Does that happen? And does this gene appear a lot in violent prison populations?
Oh, so that's a fascinating question. We don't. So if someone is engaging in a really severe or repetitive, almost compulsive act of violence, or if it seems that violence is really running in someone's family, so their father was in prison, they're in prison, we never stop and think as a system, is there something biological that's going on? Should these people be tested genetically. I mean, sometimes it's brought in, you know, brought up by maybe an enterprising defense attorney in a sentencing part of the case, but it's not, it's definitely not part of like our routine practice. So there's at least
It sounds like it should be, right? I mean, if we look at people who have committed violent crimes, but they have a specific variant of a gene that means they're unable to regulate their impulsive desires. I mean, surely you would have to take that into account if you're deciding how to sentence someone. Like, let's role play, right? I'm the judge. You're pulled in by the defense to talk about this one guy who's on death row for violent crime. You know, what would you say in that situation? Would you say, you know, Your Honor, this defendant doesn't have the same capability to restrict himself, and so shouldn't be judged in the same way?
I mean, I generally agree with you. I would say that we already take into account when we sentence offenders what the U.S. Supreme Court called the frailties of human nature. And so it's very common when we're trying to decide how culpable is someone for their crime to look at, well, did they have an abuse history? Were they raised by an alcoholic mother? Did they begin drinking when they were 12?
Right.
Did they live in poverty? Can that help us understand how they came to be the way that they are and how they came to do what they've done, as horrible as it is. And I think genetics should be thought of in a similar frame. Another thing that humanizes a defendant and helps us understand, I'm not saying that what you did is right, but I am having empathy and understanding about how you came to do that in the first place.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that is not an intuition that's universally shared.
I bet it's not in Texas where you're based.
we are a very punitive state in a very punitive country. And on average in the United States, when genetics has been entered into the sentencing phase of capital crimes, it hasn't made any difference to judges and juries. And there's some evidence suggests that it might actually make some people more punitive, that they think, oh, not that this humanizes you. I can see how you've come to behave this way, but oh, you're bad to the bone. You're a natural born killer. I'm even more afraid of you. We need to lock you up for even longer.
Right.
And it's that duality of, is the genetics a constraint on your choice, or is the genetics a reflection of who you truly are? That can cut both ways when we're talking about guilt and responsibility.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, that you don't want to bring up the fact that you are predisposed to this, in case people say, well, then throw them in a cell and throw away the key. Well, are there other genes that make you more likely to hurt people?
So there aren't other genes that we know of that have these kind of huge effects like MAOA. So that is an extremely large effect on behavior. But there's actually, at this point, hundreds of genes that we've identified that raise your probability a little bit. And the way that we find these is by, again, looking at the DNA data of millions of people. My colleagues and I published a paper a couple of years ago where we're looking at the DNA of 1.5 million people. And we find a couple of genes that pop up again and again. And again, they're not deterministic, but they are associated with an increased likelihood of behaving impulsively across the board. So you are having sex with more people. You're more likely to experiment with drugs. You're using drugs more frequently. And one of the impulsive things that people do sometimes is they impulsively aggress against another person.
Yeah.
So you see this kind of impulsivity that can stretch from very minor things to very severe things. And we can see specific genes that are associated with that kind of whole span of behavior.
And just like genetics can be associated to something like, you know, whether or not you're more likely to hurt someone or drink too much or get in arguments, in the book, you kind of talk about other things that we would assume have nothing to do with genes, like being religious. But these do have, if you look at large populations, an element of genetic influence.
Yeah. So, and a similar sort of strategy, if you look at identical twins who are separated at birth, they've never had any contact with one another. They are similar in their religiousness, whether they believe in God, whether they go to church, whether they believe in free will, which is ironic. And if you look at how kids resemble their parents, kids resemble their biological parents much more than they resemble their adoptive parents if they've been adopted in their levels of religiousness.
Wow.
And I think that surprises people because we still tend to have these kind of implicitly dualistic beliefs that there's parts of our behavior that are about our bodies. And of course, that's going to be influenced by our genetics, but that then there's our spirit or our soul, and that's somehow disconnected from our body. But I'm a psychologist. And so I think of, you know, religion is a belief. It is a practice. It is a social experience. Mm. And it's produced by a brain. And that brain is being built by
genes and environment.
So I
wanted to finish off just talking about what we can do. So, I mean, there are now genetic therapies available for certain conditions. We're learning how to influence genes using things like CRISPR and apply changes to somebody to, you know, to cure disease. Is it possible that in the future we might have some sort of genetic therapy for those who have this extremely violent version of the MAOA gene, that we might be able to actually fix their genes so they're less likely to be violent?
So I think if someone has a clear monogenic disorder, and MAOA is clearly a monogenic disorder, that is the sort of use case where one day we might have a CRISPR, a gene editing technology. Again, for the vast majority of people, their behavior isn't caused by one gene. It's caused by hundreds or thousands of genes working in operation. And that's not the sort of thing where we are going to be CRISPRing, you know, gene editing thousands of genes in someone's genotype. I think a good example here, a good kind of metaphor here, is to think about Ozempic and body weight. So body weight is also caused by thousands and thousands of genes working in combination with one another and with the environment. But if you push really hard on one biological mechanism, which is GLP-1, you can really shift someone's weight. And I'm really interested in thinking about a future in which we can identify, is there a biological pathway that we could not gene edit, but maybe a pharmacological therapy that could help people whose primary difficulty is with impulsivity and difficulties in self-regulation?
Mm. Interesting weapon, though, that could turn out to be, of course. So you want to be very careful about how you make this and how you make it available.
Because, of course. We're not interested in conformity. We're not interested in making everyone the same. But there's a freedom or a lack of freedom that can come from being driven by your own impulses. And, you know, right now, if your kid's primary problem is they're depressed, or your primary problem is you're depressed, you know, there are tools, both therapy and pharmacological things, are really effective for that. If the primary problem is impulsive aggression, it's a lot harder.
Yeah, for sure. Catherine Paige Harden is professor of psychology at University of Texas and author of Original Sin, The Genetics of Wrongdoing, The Problem of Blame, and The Future of Forgiveness. Paige, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Future Proof Extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.